Hold on.
Happy New Year, everybody.
That's right. Happy New Year, everybody. It is Friday, December 31st, 2010, the last day of 2010. Mila and I are here. It's our last day on the vacation. Isn't that right, Mila? Tell everybody the big news.
Well, I lost two teeth already. One I just lost yesterday, and one I lost a couple weeks ago.
So there you have it, folks. That's the big news of the day. Because there's no other big news of the day, we're going to play something from the Majority Report archives, an interview that Janine and I did. Hold on, kiddo. Will you turn that off for 1 second? That Janine and I did with Malcolm Gladwell. So here it comes, and we will be back live on Monday. Got some great shows for you. And starting next week, I'll be doing Ring of Fire. Check your local listings. We can talk about it on the show. Enjoy, folks. Have a happy, happy new year, and happy and healthy to your entire family. Okay, bye.
We are back on the Majority Report. I'm Janine Garofalo here with Sam Cedar, and in studio, best-selling author and staff writer for The New Yorker, Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is called Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. He also is the author of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. Welcome, Malcolm.
Thank you. I'm glad to be
You're
here.
Malcolm.
No.
I haven't heard that since third grade.
I actually was going to say, we used to say that in elementary school all the time. Thank you. You're Malcolm. And here you are.
Wow, I had never picked up on that. Well, thank you so much for coming in. It was wonderful talking to you. Now, tell us a little bit about Blink. Why Blink?
Why? Well, Blink is about it's about rapid cognition. It's about the kind of thinking that goes on in the blink of an eye, and the stuff that comes from our unconscious and how it affects the way we think and behave. And it plays a much bigger role than we generally, I think, realize. It plays a big role in a bad way. It's the kind of engine of discrimination and racism and stuff like that. And it plays a big role in a good way. It's how we make sense of the world. And I think we've been neglecting this kind of thinking to our peril. And I wanted to kind of shed a light on it.
Why do you think we've been? I guess the question is, why do you think we've been neglecting it? And why do you think it's to our peril?
We've been neglecting it because it's not obvious. Because we like to believe that everything we do, whether we understand everything that we do. So you ask me, Malcolm, are you a racist? And I say, I'm not. You know, I believe in the equality of the races. My mom's black, you know, blah, 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 right? But the fact is what I'm aware of is only a fraction of who I am. There's a whole part of me that's below the surface of consciousness, and that makes a profound difference in how I treat people. And, you know, so when we neglect the unconscious, when we say that the only thing that matters are the things that we're aware of, we leave half of ourselves basically forgotten. And that's why we neglect it. It's just that it's not obvious.
Well, you could sort of say that a little bit of what you're talking about in Blink maybe is intuition, gut mm-hmm. reaction to something. Mm-hmm. But in the same way, when you talk about experience when people are playing poker, or there's three decks, and one deck is really good, one deck is terrible, and one deck, I guess, might be...
It's two. Yeah, one's terrible, one's good, and you have to make kinds of decisions. And what you find is that people figure out what the bad deck is well before they're aware that they've figured out the bad deck. In other words, we make all kinds of decisions that... good decisions about the world. We figure out patterns on an unconscious level long before we know that we've figured them
right,
out.
Right, so your unconscious figures out that this deck is not good. So you start slightly avoiding it before you consciously avoid mm-hmm. that bad deck.
Yeah.
How is it that your unconscious figures out that it's not good?
Because it's like we have two brains. The conscious brain is the brain that deals with a very limited number of things. Right now you're looking at me, right?
Yes.
And you're aware that you're looking at me, and you're taking in this marvelous example of manhood, right?
Yes. It's quite impressive.
Thank you. But simultaneously, your brain is gathering all kinds of information from sound, you know, sight, smell from all around the room, and you don't even know where that you're gathering all that data. But in fact, the majority of the information your brain is gathering at this second is being gathered by your unconscious. So there's a whole part of our brain that's like a giant computer humming away in the background. And it does all kinds of stuff for us. When you walk down the street, it makes sure you don't bump into people. You're not thinking about that consciously, right?
Well, I mean, so, but how would the unconscious, I mean, because I understand the notion of like, okay, there's sounds that are coming in, there's visual stimuli, there's auditory and the nose is.
Yeah.
And
the nose part.
Exactly, the nose part. But how would I get unconscious messages from a deck of cards? That doesn't look any different than another deck.
Or what's going on is that they're in this famous card experiment. Basically, a pattern begins to emerge when you start playing with these cards long enough that makes it clear that the red decks are really bad and the blue decks are really good, right? And the question is, how long does it take you to figure out the pattern? Well, most of us figure out the pattern after we've turned over about 50 cards. At the same time as our conscious brain is looking for a pattern, our unconscious brain is looking for a pattern as well, but it figures out the pattern after 10 cards. It's just faster. It's a bigger computer. And it's working much more quickly. And it tells us to start avoiding those terrible red cards long before we're even aware that we're supposed to be avoiding those terrible red cards.
Now, as you are well aware, I'm sure, Freud, id, ego, superego, the conscious, the unconscious mind. And if we're going to apply this to how the unconscious mind operates, and we're talking about the superego and the id, which I'm assuming are unconscious, and the ego is conscious, I always get muddled up with these things. But if the superego is your best self and the id unrestrained is your worst, wherein does this pattern fall in of maybe figuring out the deck of cards or how you respond to political messages, how you treat other people?
It's a slightly different concept. I mean, the modern notion of the unconscious, they now call it the adaptive unconscious, differs from the Freudian notion of the unconscious. Freud was really interested in the places in your mind where you bury bad things, where you bury the memory you can't face, where you bury, you know, all these kind of horrible or sexual or something, things that you didn't want to own up to. The modern psychologist concedes that, you know, may or may not be of importance, but says, wait a minute, there's another role that our unconscious plays, and that is as this kind of computer, this kind of valet who helps us make sense of the world around us. And so they tend to stress the functional aspect of our unconscious. So they don't use those terms, you know, superego, id. They're much more interested in this idea that there's a part of our brain that's kind of helping us navigate the world around us that has certain kind of tendencies. And we have to know those tendencies if we're going to understand why we behave the way we do as human beings.
Now, before we get into how we can tap into that functional aspect, the subconscious as a functional concept, how is the subconscious as a functional concept different or distinct, or maybe it isn't, from the notion of instinct that an animal might have?
Yeah. Well, all of us have a certain set of instincts that are really no different from the instincts that animals have that go back millions and millions of years, right? If a very, very large, angry man bursts through that door with a big gun in his hand, we would all run, right? And so would animals, right? I mean, the person's scary. That's a certain kind of instinct. I'm actually interested in Blink in describing a more sophisticated version of that, which is the kind of instincts that we develop as the result of experience. So, you know, an extreme example of this is a football player, a football quarterback. A very experienced football quarterback goes back in the pocket and takes a look at the defense and where his players are. And in the space of, what, a second and a half, maybe makes 50 decisions, right?
Right.
Diagnoses what he sees in front of him, makes a decision that often or not is correct, right? That's a very, very sophisticated kind of instinctive judgment. He's not consciously, it's not like solving a math problem, right? He's looking at it, and it's all happening really, really quickly, and it's the result of spending hours and hours and hours
and
hours.
It's developed.
Yeah, it's developed.
It's a learned trait. Almost.
A learned, and that's what I'm interested in, the learned, our learned instincts, and because they're tremendously interesting, and it raises the question of, well, if we have this kind of powerful part of our mind that can be trained, then how ought we train it? What are the kinds of things we can do to make ourselves better instinctive?
All right, well, let's talk about that. How can we be more conscious of what our subconscious is, the messages our subconscious is receiving, and the conclusions it's calculating. How can we become more conscious of that, and how can we also enhance the training of that?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a story that I tell in Blink, which I think is a good illustration of this. I tell the story of what happened in the world of classical music when they put up screens in auditions. An audition is a classic instinctive judgment. If you talk to people who do classical music auditions, they'll tell you they decide whether someone can play in two or three notes. Boom. Right? You know. And for years and years and years, orchestras only ever hired men. And they would always say, well, it must be because men are better because, you know, we invite in women and men for auditions and the men always win, right? We make an instinctive judgment the men are better. And then in the early 1980s, for an entirely separate set of reasons, they started to put up screens so that people on the audition committee couldn't see the person playing. And they immediately start hiring women. Instantly. That the day the screens go up, at the Met in New York, guy told me the day they had no women on the orchestra, they put up a screen in 1983. They were looking for three violinists. They hired three women violinists. Mm. Right? Now, what that says is, look, here was a case where, in a way that they were unaware of, their unconscious feelings about women were corrupting their ability to make a successful unconscious judgment about how well someone could play music. They had no idea that was going on. None of these guys thought that they were biased. They thought they were making an accurate judgment. The screen went up, and all of a sudden they start choosing women. They're like, oh, my God, all this time, in some way that I was unaware of, my ability to make sense of my own chosen field was hijacked by my these unacknowledged feelings I had that said that women couldn't cut it, right? So there's a case. What do? We fix the problem by acknowledging the power of bias and going in there and just putting up a screen, blocking out the corrupting source of information and forcing these people to focus on what really mattered, which was how well can you play? And we do that, and we, in other words, we understand that and we step in and we retrain the unconscious. And the result is that we now have the major symphony orchestras in this country are 50% women.
Okay, so I understand based on that story how you can maybe break down certain assumptions that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that is by looking at the different things that could possibly affect your judgment in a situation.
Yeah.
Or your but how can you train to avoid that? Is it simply by going through that exercise?
Yeah, there's all kinds of there isn't one general answer. I spend a lot of time talking about police work in Blink, and there are very specific kinds of things. Once you acknowledge that making a decision, an unconscious decision in the moment is something that's incredibly complex, far more complex than it realizes, there are specific ways you can train police officers. And I go in at great length about it. I talk about I suppose we can come back later and talk about the Diallo case. But
yes, let's. Well, we got to take a break, and we'll come back. Maybe we'll talk about the Diallo case. We're talking to Malcolm Gladwell. He is the staff writer for The New Yorker and the best-selling author of two books now, right?
Yes,
Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, and The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. We'll be right back in The Majority Report.
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
We are back on The Majority Report. I'm Janine Garofalo here with Sam Cedar and Malcolm Gladwell, best-selling author and staff writer for The New Yorker. Malcolm's latest book is called Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. He is also the author of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. And right before we left, we were talking about, we weren't talking about the people noticing lying. That was during the commercial break. Sorry. Sam, what was your last point? Before we start talking about the...
I didn't have a last point. The last point that we were talking about was...
Cops.
Cops and how you become more conscious
how
of
you
your
train
subconscious.
Your mind.
Yes.
How you can train your mind. Well, the thing is, you know, you were talking about perceptions built up, like say it's the quarterback, through repeated training of himself. He can understand the field and where to throw the ball. But there are a lot of people laboring under a redundancy of misperceptions. And, perception is not reality. But for most people, the world ends at the end of their nose. And their perception is indeed reality.
Mm-hmm.
And they will even say things, well, in my experience, immigrants have always been lazier on the job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're built up misperceptions are their reality. I don't know that you could retrain that kind of thinking because you were talking also earlier about in music, they put up screens when people were auditioning and that the gentlemen picking musicians we're unconsciously thinking that men are better players. I don't know that that's unconscious, and I would be interested to see how they felt about women in all other areas of their life, because that's a bold, sweeping statement. Men are just better musicians.
Yeah.
Now, that's an odd thing to say. It's so general that, to me, it bespeaks a bias against women in general.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's possible?
Well, I have several
responses. So it is conscious.
One is that in that case, what they would say is, in the case of music, that they would say, we've had auditions for years. Men and women have come to these auditions. Men have always won, right? So they would claim to have some objective basis for their belief that women were inferior musicians. What they failed to understand, of course, was that the open audition is rigged. It's rigged by all of their biases that they're carrying around that they're unaware of. Does that correlate to broader social attitudes towards women? Oh, absolutely. I'm convinced it is. And that's why we didn't solve the problem of bias against women in general. We just solved it in the case of classical music. And that's a very important truth. And that when we're trying to improve people's decisions in various contexts, there is no master solution. All we can do is to break down the specific situations where we think we go the most wrong and try and come up with specific solutions to that. So I was talking about cops earlier. There are specific things you can do to make police officers better decision makers, when they're dealing with high-pressure, high-stakes situations on the street. Now, does that generalize out to the rest of society? No. But we can make cops better decision-makers. Absolutely. Right? And this book is all about very specific and focused solutions.
Well, does it go on then with making people better critical thinkers in general? The public school system is not in the business of creating critical thinkers, really, as a rule. And it's decayed even further as budget cuts and mm-hmm. as time has gone on and you have, 40 pupils per one teacher sharing textbooks, things of that nature, and salaries being just terrible for teachers. It's very hard to get good teachers. So you don't have a lot of critical thinking being taught from K through 12, mm-hmm. as it is. Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's not a component of the personality that seems to be valued in our society.
Yeah. Excuse me. You're right in the sense that one of the things I was trying to do with Blink is to get us to think in a more sophisticated way about thinking. And I think you're right that we have neglected, we tend to sort of gloss over these sorts of complexities in many different fields, not just education and not just, police work. But I have a lot of discussion of medical decision-making, for instance. Look, this is a huge issue with medical decision. We know, to return to the subject of bias, that doctors diagnosing chest pain treat women and blacks very different from white men. Look, there's something going on there, and we need to address it. And addressing it requires a more creative and complete understanding of how thinking happens than the medical profession is used to.
Now, let's talk a little bit. We only have a couple minutes left. The Amadou Diallo case.
Yeah. I'm going to get myself into trouble, but
not here, you won't.
Freddie Ferreira, I'm not sure I disagree with him in his statements on the Diallo case. I was interested in that case because my feeling was...
Tell people what his comments are.
Freddie Ferreira is the mayoral candidate here in New York who said of the four officers who were charged with shooting Amadou Diallo that night that he wasn't sure they had committed a crime. And they did something terrible that night. But my feeling is that I'm not sure that if I was in their shoes, I would have behaved any differently. In other words, the kinds of biases they were carrying around and the situation in which the NYPD put them, which is four guys with almost no experience on a dark street in the middle of the night, cruising around, supposed to look for trouble, it was so fraught and demanding that, we were asking for trouble. Basically.
Like the Iraqi soldiers, the soldier that was acquitted of shooting the unarmed, injured Iraqi on video, acquitted. Lindy England, mistrial, mm-hmm. thrown out. It is asking for trouble.
It's asking questions.
It's the idea being that there's so much, telling them that they should be worried in that situation.
Because what we do by placing all the blame squarely on those four cops, what we do is we excuse the system. And the system was very powerfully at fault here. And if we want cops to be better decision makers, we have got to train them properly to be better decision makers. And when they screw up, we ought to blame the people who didn't train them properly. And I feel that with the Diallo case, we just forgot that fact. And we took the easy way out and just said, oh, these guys are racist. Well, you know what? There's more there than that.
Well, and I'm sure that the same thesis applies for what happened in Abu Ghraib. I mean, if something like that happens, it's because there has been a dysfunction in the system that allows for something to happen. All right, I wish we had more time. It's really fascinating stuff. The book is Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. I'm also sure you'd be happy if they bought The Tipping Point as well. But I have a feeling if you buy one, you'll want to buy the other. I mean, assuming you read it. Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much. Majority Report, next hour we'll be back. We'll be talking to Ben Stiller about the ALS project.
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
I want... Boy, we got straight next.